Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Irving for three. Irving fakes, drives. James on the throwdown. James down low. Back up top, J.R. Smith for three. James to Thompson. Oh, what a pass from LeBron James. 31-9. Irving the crossover. Irving the pull-up. Tries again. Connects. James the crossover. The layup off the glass. For Dante Jones inside. Layup is good.
Curry the rebound. Green down the other end. James right there. Blocked by James.
Kyrie Irving misses. Tristan Thompson hauls in the rebound. His 11th of the game. Finds James. Here's Irving. Four to shoot. Finds Tristan Thompson out to Love for three. Bang. Pass inside. Stolen by Irving. Throws it ahead to Smith. Smith. Alley-oop to James. Wow.
Crowd going crazy. J.R. Smith in transition, recognizing the locomotive running down the middle of the floor is not how you drive, it's how you arrive. Mama, there goes that man.
It's bedlam here in Cleveland. Curry blocked by James.
Making a statement on both sides of the floor. Says to the two-time MVP, get it out of here. Not on my watch.
Thompson misses his third free throw of the night. As Tristan Thompson able to get that deflected rebound. And a foul on Curry, and Curry's going to get it with a technical. He throws his mouthpiece after fouling out of the game.
And it hit a fan, Mike.
Well, that had nothing to do with the outcome. The outcome was decided. He had every right to be upset. You know, he's the MVP of the league. He gets six fouls called on him. Three of them were absolutely ridiculous. You know, he steals the ball from Kyrie clean. LeBron flops on the last one. Jason Phillips falls for that for a flop. As the MVP of the league, we're talking about these touch fouls in the NBA Finals. Let me be clear. We did not lose because of the officiating. They totally outplayed us, and Cleveland deserved to win. Three of the six fouls were incredibly inappropriate calls.
I didn't think I fouled either Kyrie or LeBron. That's just kind of my perception of the plays, and I had a reaction to it. You know, it's obviously frustrating fouling out in the fourth quarter of a clinching game and not being out there with my teammates, so it got the best of me, but you know, I'll be all right for the next game.
I just thought, you know, we stuck with our game plan, you know, being aggressive and physical defensively, and I thought being aggressive offensively of attacking. Just our guys fight and our determination and never want to give in.
Well, man, we just focus on the next game. We focus on the next minute. We focus on the game plan that we had to master up, you know, to try to even, you know, get to, you know, the next play, you know, and it wasn't even trying to get to a game seven. We was like, okay, well, and once we went to game five, we went out there and being down 3-1, we was like, okay, well, we got to go home anyway. So let's go home and play in front of our fans. And tonight, you know, these guys were, I mean, unbelievable. Once again, Double T's energy and activity is level. His rebounding, obviously giving us extra possessions, but, you know, his defensive rebounding from the beginning was at an all-time high level for himself. Even though as great as he is, he was a spectacular tonight, and Kyrie's just a floor general. He does what he does. I mean, it's no surprise what he does. And, you know, we put ourselves in position to be able to, you know, to be in the game seven.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, boy, and a good Friday to all of you. Welcome into this edition of the Extravaganza. Jim Cushlin in for Bob France on this Friday. I got Chris Lemieux hanging out with me as well for the next couple of hours. And to a certain degree, I can't believe that we're here. With the way this series has gone in these NBA Finals, that we will be looking at a Game 7 coming up on Sunday, a game, by the way, we'll have for you right here on the Ticket, 7 o'clock, the pregame time, on your Sunday to wrap up your upcoming weekend as the Cavs get another win at home this time against the Warriors yesterday, and so many little funny subplots to the whole thing. I mean, the last part of the highlights you just heard, Curry getting thrown out, no suspensions or anything, so any of you Cavs fans wanted to get your hopes up, I could have told you last night that's not going to happen, but he totally got fined for that one, as did Steve Kerr, the former Cav and now Warriors coach, for specifically those comments you heard there. Anytime you say something pressers about the officials, just break out your checkbook immediately. I'm sure Steve Kerr had that check written by the end of the third quarter yesterday, the way that game was going. And now we are on to Game 7, which is a place that many, myself included, didn't think we'd be at. Well, really, coming up to about this time, not this time a week ago, but Saturday, because last a week ago today was Game 4, when the Cavs had just come off their Game 3 win and then go into Game 4, which they ended up ultimately losing. And then you have Draymond Green coming back, and he was kind of a ghost. Maybe it's Andrew Bogut missing that messes everything up. I have no idea. If your name wasn't Steph Curry or Klay Thompson, you literally did not show up to play yesterday. I mean, goodness, what is Harrison Barnes, they said, in the last two games now? Like 2-for-22 or something just horrid? Meanwhile, LeBron has another absolute game for the ages. 41-11-8, 16-27 from the field. Also had 4 steals, 3 blocks. You heard 2 of the 3 blocks. Some stare downs. Kind of ticky-tack fouls both ways. You know, I know Kerr and them would say otherwise, but there were 25 fouls called on each team yesterday. Even though Curry fouled out, there were more Cavs guys than Warriors guys with 4-plus fouls yesterday when it went final. I mean, actually, just looking at it again, let's see. Tristan had 4, JR had 5, and then you had the 5 for Draymond and the 6 for Curry, and a bunch of other players on both teams each with 3.
Yeah, I noticed in the
things
game...
things being thrown, it's just insane.
Yeah, I noticed, like, early in the game, like, the Warriors were in the bonus, like, real early.
Yeah, like, and so were the Cavs in the first quarter, and you're going to get that with that kind of those kind of calls, and... Even though I think thinking back on at least one of the Curry calls, Steve Kerr probably has a point. But really, at minimum, 3 of those were, quite frankly, bad fouls by Steph Curry. Reaching in when you don't have to. Things of this nature. And we are actually going to Game 7, which is coming up on Sunday. You can hear it right here on the ticket. 7 o'clock pregame time. We're going to talk more about this Game 6 and getting you ready for Game 7. Dave Zaback, FearOfTheSword.com, will join us at the bottom of the hour. Your phone calls throughout the rest of the show today. Jim Kushlin in for Bob France here on this Friday edition of the Extravaganza. 866-240-1065. I can take some calls right now if you got thoughts on what you saw last night and what you may be seeing coming up on Sunday. Spoiler alert, I'm actually still leaning Warriors on this one. Mostly because it's at Golden State. And that's why you get home court when you win more games. It's that simple. But I wouldn't put it past the Cavs to pull off this improbableness. And it is completely improbable. I did some research earlier today. By now, everybody's heard about the 0-32 all-time in the finals. We're just measuring finals here when being down 3-1. As we know, it's happened 10 times in NBA history, the last one being the Warriors just a few weeks ago in the West Finals, but it's never yet happened in the Finals. Okay, you guys knew that one. Here are the ones you may not know. Out of those 32, only 2 of them ever even brought it to Game 7, and those were in the ancient times of the NBA. The 1951 Knicks, who, after being down 3-1, forced a Game 7 against the Rochester Royals. Huh? What? The Rochester Royals, you know them now as the Sacramento Kings via Kansas City, via Oscar Robertson and Jerry Lucas in Cincinnati. So they've been through 3 other cities since it was the Rochester Royals. I told you it was ancient days. And the other was in 1966. Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, the Lakers went down 3-1 to the Bill Russell Celtics. And, well, when you're talking the Bill Russell Celtics, you know how those stories end. Here's another one, though, for you. Because the series was 3-1, kind of lost in the mix is how the Cavs were also down 0-2 in this series. There's only been 17 of those comebacks ever. Cavs did it once in that 0-7 East Finals against the Pistons.
as I'm sure fans of both fan bases, of course, are very aware of. In the finals, being down 0-2 to win has only happened three times. 69, the Celtics over the Lakers. 77, Bill Walton and those Blazers were down 0-2 to Dr. J and the Sixers. In, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. J's second year in the NBA. Or is it first? No, check that. It was first year in the NBA because 76 was the end of the ABA. So in his first season in Philly in the NBA, Dr. J's Sixers go up 2-0 in the finals and lose to Bill Walton and the Portland Trailblazers. The third time was in 2006 when the Mavericks went up 2-0 on the Shaq and Wade Heat only to lose four straight. So only three times in the finals has a team ever been down 0-2 to come back. And here's an even more fascinating note. Forget finals for a second. This is all time. 10 times a team's come back from down 3-1 to win, and 17 times a team's come back from down 0-2 to win, right? Only one team ever can claim both. In other words, they started down 0-2, won a game 3, lost game 4, were down 3-1, and then won 3 straight. There's only one team that's ever done it. 95 Houston Rockets with Hakeem and Clyde. And I believe Kenny the Jet Smith was still on that team. Did it over the Charles Barkley Suns in the West Semis in 95. The only team to ever go down 0-2 and 3-1 in the same series and come back and win. I bring that up because the Cavs would be the second team ever if they continue what we've seen these last couple of games. And there's so many side notes to it all as well. You got Curry getting ejected. And yes, it was a foul out and an ejection when the whole temper tantrum came and the mouthpiece got thrown at the fan. Fan, by the way, is the son of one of the Cavs minority owners, incidentally, not just any fan. And to Curry's credit, he immediately shook their hands and apologized, saying, hey, I totally didn't mean to smack you guys with that one. And he didn't. But he then got subsequently ejected on the technical. That's why there was a technical free throw. So you got that. You got Draymond Green. Hey, we'd have won in 5 games if only I was there. He had double-digit rebounds. Good for him. But otherwise, he was a ghost. And I did not see that coming. I tweeted after game 5. That, okay, love everything that happened, a lot of reasons for this game, but stop calling me crazy when I say Draymond Green is the cog that makes that engine go. And the ABC guys were very poignant at one point in the first quarter when the Cavs blitzed him again. This was wire to wire. Remember, it was 8-0 to start the game. Eventually a 20-point lead. Warriors would get it as close as 8 in the first half, 7 in the second. Because, you know, they can. Curry still had 30 points, and they feel like the ugliest 30 points I've ever seen because of the fouling out and the rest of his team not doing squat. Oh, check that. Klay Thompson had a good second quarter, but that was about it. And he got 25. Nobody else had double. No, check that. Leandro Barbosa had some points in garbage time to get him over 10. But you have all that. And then you have LeBron going supernova the last couple games. You have Kyrie right there. Tristan Thompson was an absolute behemoth yesterday. And it's not just because Bogut was out and they didn't have their rim protector. This goes back to the Draymond Green thing. Because they started the death lineup. They started with it. Andre Iguodala was there. I didn't know which one they'd exactly go with. I heard rumblings yesterday that they might go with Iguodala. And if you're a Warriors fan, I'd say you'd be most worried about him right now. Because Vigor Curry and Thompson at home will make enough shots. Green will play better. But what the heck is wrong with Iguodala's back? If he can't play, is LeBron just going to go to the hole every time we make or miss a three? Could. Tristan Thompson was everywhere. Kyrie chipped in. Heck, even in a stretch, and the stats won't bear this out, there was a good stretch in the third quarter by Kevin Love, of all people. He had a couple shots and helped turn it back a little bit around when the Warriors were making a run. Now, things are still not necessarily in the Cavs' favor. Home teams are 15-3 all time in game sevens of the finals. The only three times a team won the finals on the road in game seven, 1969 Celtics over the Lakers, and we already mentioned that same Celtics team was down 0-2 to those Lakers. 1974, The Celtics won a Game 7 in Milwaukee against Kareem's Bucks. Because remember, Kareem, for all those who may forget, Kareem was a Milwaukee Buck before he was an L.A. Laker. And then in 1978, Wes Unseld and the Bullets won in Seattle. Which, by the way, is just a humorous dynamic to illustrate how long ago it's been since a road team has won a Game 7. The Bullets are called the Wizards now, and there is no more basketball in Seattle. I still personally hope that changes. That would still, to me, that was still a tragedy, what the owner of the current Thunder did to move the Sonics out of Seattle. But that's neither here nor there. I'm just putting it in that context to show you how long ago that was. So the odds are still against the Cavs for a whole bunch of reasons that I just laid out. And you wonder if, with 2 days off because they're doing this in these finals for travel, which is perfect, you know, going to and from the West Coast, maybe momentum doesn't carry over. Maybe it does. It certainly felt like it yesterday. Cavs just blitzed them. Warriors not named Curry or Thompson were invisible. And there's so many points that this series could go. And the conversations we'll have next week based on what happens on Sunday. This may be one of the most interesting, despite how the first six games of the series has gone, i.e., the winner of each game is won by double digits. In fact, yesterday was the first game that the losing team scored over 100 points in this series. The losing team's been held under 100 in every game in the series so far. But there are so many historical things that we'll end up talking about on Monday and Tuesday, regardless of who wins on Sunday. Because on the one hand, if it's the Warriors, here's a team that won 73 games, new face of the NBA. In a previous round, they had to make their own down 3-1 comeback, nearly blow it in the finals against basically the gatekeeper. The current gatekeeper of the NBA is LeBron James. And to do all that and finish off with a title. So there's plenty of history on that side. Then on the other side, you'd have the first ever team to come back from down 3-1 in the finals to win. Fourth team ever on the road to do it. It also become the fourth finals team ever to come back from 0-2. It will change the whole narrative we've been having these last 2 weeks as this series first started when it was 0-2 and 1-3 in favor of the Warriors. About LeBron's legacy and how do you view it with five finals losses. We were speaking of it in a way that we just assumed it would be five finals losses. We were starting to dive into it. That completely changes if it becomes not just 3-4, but in the manner of doing it. The comeback against this specific team. And, oh, by the way, let's throw in the whole Cleveland curse thing to boot. I'm going to go ahead and say it right now. And others may disagree with me. Bob, when he returns on Monday, may even disagree with me on this. If LeBron and these Cavs finish pulling this out, on Sunday, in my humble opinion, there is no more arguments. LeBron would be back to being the best player on the planet, period. Curry is number two, period, if the Cavs win on Sunday. He's the first player since Shaq in 01 to score 40-plus in multiple finals games. This, of course, after the other night's Game 5. Where LeBron and Kyrie became the first teammates ever to score 40-plus in a single finals game. So there's so much history that we'll end up talking about Monday and Tuesday, regardless of who wins this game on Sunday. And I kind of thought we wouldn't be here. I was hoping that they maybe without Green they could force it back to Cleveland. And then I did say they'd win Game 6. Because it felt different than Game 6 a year ago, which was on the exact same date, ironically enough. It was June 16th last year that they played Game 6 in Cleveland. But that series was going a different direction at that time. Now it's going the complete opposite direction. So I kind of figured maybe they'd win a Game 6, but I still think the Warriors would win in 7. And sadly, sorry fellow Cleveland fans, I still have that opinion today. I'm gonna do my best this entire weekend to not get myself all worked up and thinking I may finally see a title for one of my teams, which, of course, as we all know, I've never seen before. Because I still kind of think the Warriors should win. They still should. They're still the more talented team. But they just look completely out of whack right now. in a way that Oklahoma City didn't seem to knock them out of whack this bad. They rebounded in game five, remember, in that series. Klay Thompson goes off after being down by a couple possessions in the second half in an elimination game six on the road, and he goes off for 40-plus. And once you knew it, went back to seven in that scenario, from down 3-1 to 3-3 going back to Oracle. I knew it was over at that point. Thunder, to their credit, played an okay game seven. We're leading for a little bit in the first half, and then Golden State took a lead, and that was it. But this is kind of the opposite series, especially from a Warrior perspective, to that one. They're the ones choking it away. They're the ones that look lost. They're the one whose MVP has, let's face facts. The MVP, Steph Curry, has not been the MVP. And unless he goes off for like 45 and 10 threes to help Golden State win a title on Sunday, even if Golden State wins a title, I think he has to have a stat line like that. 45, maybe 10 threes or something. He will not and should not win the series MVP award. He shouldn't. When you overall base the seven games, yeah, he had 30 last night, but it sure as heck to me was the ugliest 30 I've ever seen, just because of all the other things that went around. And he had a solid game four. But outside of that, for a guy with his shooting prowess and what he is to this league right now, has been very, very small in this series overall. And that's why you don't hear a lot of people mentioning him for a possible series MVP. Again, unless he goes out and drops 45 with a whole bunch of threes and Golden State wins on Sunday. Then maybe you put him back in consideration. Obviously, if the Cavs win, LeBron James is a series MVP. I don't think there's any question about that. So it's actually happening. On Sunday in a Game 7, and a game we'll have for you here, 7 o'clock the pregame time, right here on 106.5 The Ticket. Jim Quisling here on this Friday, I should say, edition of the Extravaganza. Got Chris Lemieux hanging out with me. Bob France taking the day off today. He'll be back, of course, on Monday, though. We'll talk with Dave Zaback of FearOfTheSword.com. More on this Game 6 and looking ahead to Game 7 on Sunday here in just a bit. We'll take your phone calls on not just Game 6 and the upcoming Game 7 of these NBA Finals. But we're going to continue, I guess you could call it, our three-part now mini-series here on the Extravaganza of the Mount Rushmore of college. Because Notre Dame's Mount Rushmore, at least on the NFL.com list, that's the one where they measure the how they did as NFL players. Notre Dame's came out this morning to complete the 10, which, of course, to review goes is Tennessee, Miami, LSU, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Michigan, Penn State, Ohio State, USC, Notre Dame. It's what they did in the NFL. We've been having a fascinating conversation the last couple days, first on Michigan a couple days ago, then on Ohio State yesterday, Notre Dame, and more today. How would you do it if you were looking at NFL players? How would you do it if you're looking at them through college? I posted on our Facebook page, so go check that out on our Ticket Facebook page. And great responses from a whole bunch of you, by the way. Not just commenting on what I threw out as my personal list for not just Michigan, Ohio State, Notre Dame. I also threw a Mount Rushmore of how they did in college for Toledo, Bowling Green. And yeah, for those who haven't seen it, come on, you guys knew I would do this. I threw out one for Virginia Tech as well, because it's me. But I love some of the responses, love the commentary, and love you guys throwing out random other schools. I got somebody who posted Pitt and TCU, among others. So go to our Facebook page at 106.5, The Ticket. It's up there right now. Throw in your own Mount Rushmores. We're going to continue that talk and analyze the Notre Dame one, who you would put on your Notre Dame one. And if you got more thoughts on Ohio State's and Michigan's and anything else on those fronts, we can take it too. Also going to touch on this as we go along today. They got a win yesterday, but it sure as heck doesn't feel like it for the Detroit Tigers as they lose J.D. Martinez to a fractured elbow. So that's going to put him on the DL. They put him immediately on the DL and immediately called up Steven Moya. As J.D. Martinez, at the worst possible time for the Tigers, he's going to miss at least a month because you fractured your elbow. I mean, my goodness. So J.D. Martinez is out. How is that going to affect the Detroit Tigers, who will continue their series in Kansas City against the Royals tonight, 7:50 pregame time. That's over on Talk Radio 1470. The Indians will welcome in the Chicago White Sox. Because of the Tigers' win, the Indians are back in first place right now by themselves. but only by a half game after getting swept in Kansas City. So we can talk about all those things. Your phone calls, we got a lot to cover again with Game 6 of the Finals. Not just the big storylines, but the smaller ones as well. Like how Dante Jones, of all people, may have helped save the Cavs in the second. Aisha Curry calling out the NBA, saying it's rigged. Should the wife of the two-time MVP really be going into that old fun conspiracy well? Well, she did it. And then some on Twitter last night also accusing the Cleveland police of racial profiling. Oh, so we're going to touch on that as well. If you got phone calls on any of this stuff, 866-240-1065. Jim Kusin, Chris Lemieux, hanging out with you on a Friday edition of the Extravaganza. You're on ESPN 106.5, the ticket in for Bob France. Quick timeout, check the weather, check the traffic, local sports center update. And then Dave Zavac, FearLessSword.com writer, Cavs side on SB Nation. We're going to break it all down for you. That's next on a Friday edition of the Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, the ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, the ticket.
And we just focus on the next game. We focus on the next minute. We focus on the game plan. And we had to master up, to try to even, get to, the next play, And it wasn't even trying to get to a game seven. We was like, okay, well. And once we went to game five, we went out there and being down 3-1, we was like, okay, well, we got to go home anyway. So let's go home and play in front of our fans.
And did they ever play in front of their fans yesterday? Complete bedlam at times in that arena last night as the Cavs get the 115-101 win, forcing the game seven, which you'll hear Sunday night, 7 o'clock pregame time, right here on 106.5. The ticket. So many angles and things to go into regarding this game and how this series has gone. And to help us break it all down, we welcome back a friend of the show. He's one of the writers for FearTheSword.com, Cavs site over there on SB Nation. He is Dave Zavac. Dave, thanks so much for taking the time. How you been?
Hey, good. Happy to be here. Happy that we still have some basketball to talk about.
Yeah, and that's something I didn't think was possible, when this week started and we're heading into Monday's Game 5. I mean, even with Draymond Green being out, you still kind of had to figure at that moment that the Warriors being at home would still have a little bit of an advantage, that even with Green out, they were sure talking like it. And now we've seen what's happened these last couple games. And obviously the first part of it is LeBron James has decided to go supernova. And it maybe some of those things that they were saying have gotten to him, talking about man's game and things like that Klay Thompson was saying. I'm not sure what it is, but we've seen LeBron hit this gear before when he wants to, and these last two games he's absolutely turned that on.
Yeah, I mean, and you sort of kept waiting for it because this has been over a full year that the Warriors have really been talking. It started a year ago after the finals and Draymond Green was having fun at the parade and said a bunch of, things about the Cavs, not being a very good team, not being much of a challenge for the Warriors, even though it had gone to six games a year ago. Then it led into the champagne stuff earlier this year. And then even after Steph Curry had made the talk about, I hope going back to the queue that we get to smell the champagne in there. Then the Warriors came out and annihilated the Cavs on their own court. And, and then again, leading into the finals, not very many people were giving the Cavs much of a chance. The Warriors in particular, there was, a Zach Lowe column about Klay Thompson saying that the Cavs had taken the wrong Thompson in 2011, and taking Tristan Thompson over Klay. Lots of stuff about how the Cavs or about how the Warriors were not worried about Kyrie Irving. And you just kept waiting for it to sort of register with the Cavs. And part of it's just that the Warriors are really good, but, it's certainly, Kyrie Irving in game five, but then especially LeBron James last two games has sort of finally found that gear that you were waiting for.
Yeah, absolutely. And going for 41 yesterday after going for 41 the game before. First guy since Shaq about 15 years ago to do that in back-to-back finals games. And as I've been saying so far today, Dave, there's so many little storylines that kind of happened in this one. And let me throw the first one that jumps out at me. A lot of people assume with Draymond Green, even with Bogut out now, that Draymond Green being back in the lineup would help make the difference. I've been one of those guys, you've heard me say this before to you, Dave, that to a certain degree, Draymond Green is the cog that makes that whole engine go. He had double-digit rebounds, but outside of that, he was surprisingly a ghost. I really didn't expect him, outside of the double-digit rebounds, to kind of have a nothing game. I really expected more out of him from that, and we didn't see that. So he goes out and says, well, we would have won in Game 5 if I had been there, and then he kind of still no-shows in Game 6. And when that happens, especially in the paint defensively, bad things happen for the Warriors. We saw that yesterday.
Well, you know, and you're 100% right. And the problem is when the Cavs go, first of all, I guess you just start at the end, which is that Tristan Thompson has been phenomenal. So Draymond Green is worried first and foremost about LeBron James. But then when you put Draymond Green at center, he has a ton of rebounding responsibility that gets added to his plate. If Andre Iguodala isn't 100%, they are just really asking Draymond Green defensively to, you know, carry a huge load. Now, Tristan Thompson only had 2 offensive rebounds last night, but Draymond Green, the Warriors couldn't get any extra opportunities like they had previously in the series. You saw Tristan Thompson finish a few lobs from LeBron James where Draymond is either waiting for that LeBron James drive or trying to guard the LeBron James drive himself, and then it's got an easy opportunity for Tristan around the basket, and he's able to finish. When you're asking Draymond Green to play center at 6'7", 240 pounds for 40 minutes against a physical player like Tristan, and frankly, the way LeBron has been playing, he's been really physical as well. Add to that the fact that Draymond hadn't really played a game in like a week. I just think he really wore down as that game went on. And, it looked like the Warriors might have been able to make, you know, some runs. And Curry got hot at times and Klay Thompson got hot at times. But they couldn't sustain it. And I think Draymond Green being a little overwhelmed was a huge part of that. I think you're right.
And not just that. I mean, you mentioned that Curry, who I think, considering everything that happened in that game yesterday, his shooting numbers plus the getting, you know, ejected thing for fouling out, it's probably the 30 ugliest points I've ever seen. He did it on 8 of 20 and 6 of 13 from beyond the arc. Klay Thompson, outside of his second quarter barrage, didn't do all that much. And quite frankly, outside of those two, nobody, it feels like nobody else really showed up for Golden State on either side. And there are reasons for that. Something's obviously up with Andre Iguodala, and that's good news for the Cavs. But to me, it's encapsulated in the number I heard out of Harrison Barnes yesterday towards the end after he'd been taken out, that he's 2 for 22 in the last 2 games. Look, we know the Warriors have the 2-time MVP, and they have Green and yada yada, but you still can't get nothing from everybody else on your team and hope to succeed. You know, it's the same thing when we talk about LeBron. He goes up for 40-something, but if nobody does anything else, then the Cavs aren't going to win. Same principles kind of in play for the Warriors, and we saw it last night.
Yeah, I mean, and Harrison Barnes, for reference for people, he turned down a $60 million-plus deal last summer, then fired his agent. And this is the worst possible time for him to run into this issue. He's also been a 40% three-point shooter the last 2 years. He has no confidence in that jump shot anymore, and it compounds his issues because when LeBron is willing to guard Draymond Green, then they have Tristan Thompson, who is waiting back to protect the rim but also guarding Harrison Barnes. If Barnes is hitting these threes, that puts the Cavs in a really difficult spot. He's passing up threes and then trying to drive on Tristan, and that's not a matchup that works for him. He's not a good enough ball handler. He can't create. And he wasted possessions for the Warriors last night in a way that was pretty painful. He's not this bad of a player, so maybe in Game 7 he turns it around, but it certainly seems to be in his head at the moment.
We're talking with Dave Zavac, FearTheSword.com writer. That's the Cavs site over there on SB Nation. Joining us here on the Extravaganza on the Ticket, Jim Kushlin and Chris Lemieux, hanging out with you today in for Bob France here on 106.5 The Ticket. Now let's get to Curry. Okay, mentioned that I think it was some of the ugliest 30 points I've ever seen because of all the other things that went on. I'm specifically, of course, referring to him fouling out and then the little escapade with the mouthpiece that hit a fan, which incidentally happened to be the son of one of the Cavs minority owners, by the way. He did apologize right away for that. I said that's whose hands he was shaking before he walked off the court. So kudos to him for that. He and Kerr already got their fines for their incidents. There should be no suspension. There won't be for this one, especially for any of you Cavs. And thinking, oh, we got to suspend Curry for that. No, that's not going to happen. Let's not even go down that road because we're just wasting time. But overall, Dave, I said this in kind of my rant to begin this show today. Despite the 30, which were kind of ugly yesterday, despite what he did in game four, which was another 30-plus game, and that's because Curry, with his outside shot, is just capable of having these kind of games, even when he looks like he's having a bad game. But overall, taking the six games as a whole, I quite frankly think the MVP has been very, very small in these finals. And yeah. I'm not sure what to attribute it to. Is it something the Cavs are doing defensively? Because I loved what they did defensively despite the losses in games one and two, where they were specifically concentrating on both the Splash Brothers and daring everyone else to beat them. I thought that was a halfway decent game plan. Just everybody else on the Warriors were making their shots, unlike now. But he hasn't come up big. He hasn't had that kind of, what's a good comparison? Like the 17 points he scored in that overtime in the semis against Portland in their run this year. He hasn't had anything close to that. He's come up very, very small for an MVP. And though I, to a degree, think that Kerr and Curry have a point, I think that the refs were very ticky-tack on both sides. Don't forget, look it up. Both teams had 25 fouls called against them, and both teams had two players with five or more fouls when that game went final. So they were being ticky-tack on both sides. But even with that, a couple of Curry's fouls that really were fouls were just dumb plays. Reaching in when you don't have to. He's looked anything but like a most valuable player.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can point to two things that the Cavs are really doing, really on both ends. First, it all starts with Kyrie Irving. Anytime that Kyrie, has stuff on him, Kyrie is attacking him immediately. Anytime that Kyrie doesn't have him on him, either LeBron or Kyrie will set up a pick with Steph Curry. The Warriors love to switch everything. And so then the Warriors have this decision, okay, are we going to switch Curry onto the ball? And the Cavs have been very, very good at finding where Curry is, attacking him relentless. I mean, over and over and over again, involving him in the defensive plays, making him work on defense on a level that doesn't really happen that often. You know, even if you look at what the Oklahoma City Thunder were doing, they could put Steph Curry on Deion Waiters and Anthony Roberson and sort of play the odds. And there were games where Roberson hit some threes and Deion Waiters can get things going a little bit, but the Warriors will take that bet. With the Cavs, they've been able to put lineups out there where the worst offensive player is Tristan Thompson. But as we saw last night, Tristan Thompson can finish lobs inside and score. So Steph is not getting any type of break defensively, and that's leading to, I think, some struggles offensively. Now what the Cavs can do to Curry, or what they have been doing defensively that's worked, is giving them their own medicine. Anytime, you know, all year long, what the Warriors have done is get four on threes going with Draymond Green after Steph Curry pick and rolls. So, you know, the way that the Cavs got blitzed in January, they'd have Kyrie and Kevin Love try and trap Curry. Curry just makes the quick pass to Draymond, and then they've got this four on three. Or, you know, teams can sort of not trap Curry, and then Curry's going to go off. Well, if Draymond goes and sets that pick, Kyrie is just switching right onto Draymond. And in games three and four and five, not in five because Draymond didn't play, the Warriors showed no interest in wanting to try and have Draymond try and attack Kyrie Irving. They did it like twice, And it wasn't something that they were willing to do consistently, because then that takes them out of sort of what their identity is. But then you've got that switch where now you have LeBron James on Kyrie, or not on Kyrie, but LeBron James on Steph Curry. And it's been very difficult for the Warriors. So, you know, I don't think that the Cavs are a great defensive team. I don't think they have great defensive personnel necessarily. They've been able to, you know, sort of take Curry out of his comfort zone a little bit and take away the downhill plays that Draymond Green has.
And despite everything you said, which is all correct, Dave, if I'm a Warriors fan right now, the thing that would concern me the most, in a more broad sense too, is the fact that due to the Bogut injury, and of course he's going to miss, I think, at least a month, which is why he's not going to play in the Olympics either, is they were forced to start the vaunted, famed death lineup, which was kind of more or less created in Game 4 last year when Steve Kerr made the switch to go small against what the Cavs were doing. This is when Bogut got benched and Iguodala went into the starting lineup. Well, now that he's not there, it's just like, the heck with it. Let's just start that lineup. And maybe it's you can't play it as your starting unit, and for the amount of time that they are forced to play it and did play it yesterday, maybe it is best to just its spurts. But if I'm a Warriors fan, I'm really concerned, even though a lot of missed shots were there as well, and you got to figure things will balance out, especially at home, and some of those shots for not just Curry and Thompson, but others will go in. But the mere fact that the death lineup started this game and the Cavs absolutely blitzed it, if I'm a Warriors fan, I'm worried, because there's a reason we're all referring to it as the death lineup.
Yeah, and that, again, it kind of just gets us back to where Tristan Thompson is. You know, Tristan did not play very well in games 1 and 2. Maybe Andrew Bogut had something to do with that. Maybe he didn't. But you're at the point in these games now where you need to have at least two of the three of Kyrie, LeBron, and Tristan on the floor at the same time, because, you know, one of the things I think is different from last year, LeBron is a lot more willing to guard Draymond this year. I don't think last year, because they didn't have Kyrie, LeBron was exerting so much offensively. He tried to avoid being put into those pick and rolls with Draymond. And so you had LeBron last year trying to guard Iguodala defensively, and then, you know, you've got Delly and Tristan in these pick and rolls with Curry and Draymond Green, and it worked for the first three games, and then Delly ultimately was hospitalized because he was working so hard.
Right.
And that's part of the greatness of what LeBron is doing right now, is that, you know, Kyrie was able to provide a lot of offense in the first half last night, but the way that LeBron was able to sustain that offensive game in the third and fourth quarters last night, while guarding Draymond Green, while guarding Steph Curry, is nothing short of, you know, the word I used in my column was historic. I mean, I just don't know that we've seen many games like that.
And the only game I could think of in that specific stretch you're talking about, Dave, Dave Zavac, of course, of FearTheSword.com Cavs site over on SB Nation, joining us here in the extravaganza to break down Game 6, get you ready for Game 7 on Sunday. Jim Kusel and Chris Lemieux in for Bob France on this Friday. The historic part comes where he had 18 points in a row, and at one point, what was it, 25 of 26 or something like that. In other words, the closest I've seen to that famed Game 5 in 07 against Detroit. And post-game, he even more alluded to the fact that he said, you guys just play some defense. I got this. You just play some defense and be in your spots, and I'll take care of the rest. And in this stretch of the third and the fourth, he was in that kind of zone. I think it was from about 5 minutes left in the third to about 6 minutes or something like that to go. So almost a full quarter, the second half of the third and the first half of the fourth. He basically went 07 Game 5. On the Warriors, and was the main guy doing everything on both ends of the floor, but especially on the offensive end. And that, to me, kind of sums up this other gear that these last couple games, seemingly after being insulted, that LeBron turned it on. We kind of mentioned this, Dave, the other day after Game 5. You know, that's what you get if you're the Warriors. You poke that bear and you woke it up. Let's hope for your sake it doesn't carry over to Game 6. Well, it did. In spades.
Yeah, and now you're looking at, I mean, an epic Game 7 where, you know, can LeBron do it one more time? It looked like Kyrie was hobbled a little bit in the second half. I'm interested to see what he can do.
Now, he did say for the record post-game and earlier today before they left that he is doing fine. It should be nothing to worry about. But it's obviously something for the next 48 hours we're all going to keep our eye on. But Kyrie, for the record, does say he should be fine.
Okay, yeah, and you know, and he might feel fine now, and then, you know, something happens in the first quarter, and you know. But at the same time, you know, he can tell himself, okay, I got 48 minutes left of this. But, yeah, I mean, the way that, you know, Richard Jefferson is talking about the opportunity that they have, the way that J.R. Smith is talking about it, I have never seen Tristan Thompson as vocal on the court as he's been over the last three games. And I don't know if that's because of, you know, Klay Thompson reportedly saying, you know, oh, you took the wrong Thompson or what, but these guys are highly motivated right now, even, you know, in the context of the situation that they're in. And they really seem to believe. So going into Oracle Arena is not easy, especially when Draymond is healthy. I'm going to, you know, you basically need Kyrie and LeBron to add up to 60 points, and then you need Tristan to do that one more time, and then I think you've got a coin flip.
I would only add to that, you need one other guy not named Kyrie and Kevin Love to show up offensively, or Kyrie and LeBron to show up offensively, whether Kevin Love can go over double digits, whether JR can knock down a couple of threes. That's about the only thing I'd add on to what you're saying to make it a coin flip or put it into the Cavs' advantage. Last thing as we're up against it, David, thanks so much as always for the time. I want to leave you with these random factoids, and especially after I mention them to you, tell me if this changes whatever your personal opinion of what you may think in Game 7 is. Okay, as we all know, and we've been hearing for a few days now, teams that go down 3-1 in the finals are 0-32. There's also, in all of NBA history, only been 10 times a team has come back to win from down 3-1, the 10th, of course, being the Warriors just a few weeks ago. I love this one. Down 3-1, forcing a Game 7, just to force a Game 7 out of those 32 defeats has only happened twice, and these were in such ancient days that it was the 51 Knicks against the Rochester Royals, and for people who don't know who the heck those guys are, you know them today as the Sacramento Kings via Kansas City and via Jerry Lucas and Oscar Robertson in Cincinnati. The other was 1966 Lakers with Elgin Baylor, Jerry West. They went down 3-1 to a Bill Russell Celtics team. But when you're talking about Bill Russell Celtics, you kind of know how that story ends. There's the fascinating one is we're all stuck on the down 3-1 part, right, Dave? But the Cavs were also down 0-2 in this series as well. Teams down 0-2 have only come back to win a finals three times, 69 the Celtics over the Lakers, 77 Bill Walton and those Blazers beat Dr. J's Sixers, and in 0-6 the Shaq and Wade Heat went down 0-2 to Dallas before winning, so that would make it the fourth. And then the other two are 15-3 is the home team's record all time in the finals in Game 7. And this is one I just figured out this morning by putting two lists together, the 3-1 and the 0-3 list, the 3-1 and the down 0-2 list, right? There's only one team ever, any playoff series, that has been down 0-2 and then 3-1 and come back to win. And that was in 95, the Houston Rockets with Hakeem Olajuwon, Clyde Drexler, and the rest over Barkley's Phoenix Suns in the West Semis in 95. That's the only team ever that's been down 0-2 and 3-1 to come back and win. So all those numbers tell me that Golden State still has the advantage. And I still personally, at least me, Dave, I still kind of like the Warriors right now in that Game 7 because they're at home. But what are your thoughts on that, especially in light of those little factoids I just threw your way?
Well, I mean, you have to hope that the way that you explained away what the Rockets did, which was, well, you know, they had Drexler and Hakeem Olajuwon, two historic greats. You have to hope that 20 years from now on the radio, some guy is talking about his hometown team and saying, this has only happened twice, but of course that team had LeBron and Kyrie. So, I think, yeah, the odds are stacked against them. That's why I didn't feel very good about going into last night. I mean, you're just you're talking about a 73-win team. You're talking about coming back from 3-1, which has never happened in the finals. I mean, you just went through it all. And it just seems so hard to believe that they could actually do it. But the belief, you know, for me that it can, that it could happen, is that they've come this far and that, the players themselves seem to really think it can happen. So I think Richard Jefferson's a pretty level-headed guy. And I mean, he's like a man possessed, and so is LeBron. So one game.
Yeah, absolutely one game. And, we can already say with certainty 2 days before this game starts that no matter who the winner is on Sunday, Monday and Tuesday, when we talk about it all, it's going to be something historic. Seriously, because on the one hand, it's either the Warriors and the 73 wins and Curry and the MVP and down 3-1 in a previous series, almost blew it, but still held on for their all-time greatness. Or you got LeBron and the Cavs breaking all the factoids I just said. And, oh, by the way, let's throw in the breaking the Cleveland curse thing while we're at it. So no matter how you look at it, we're going to be talking something historical coming up on Monday and probably into Tuesday. Dave, we always appreciate the time, always appreciate the insight. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the game on Sunday, and we'll have to have you back on down the line, of course.
Hey, sounds good. Talk to you soon.
That is Dave Zavac, one of the writers, FearTheSword.com, Cavs site over on SB Nation. Game 7, two words I didn't think I'd be saying about 5 days ago. Well, it's happening Sunday night, 7 o'clock pregame time, right here on the Ticket. We got to take a quick time out, get you checking traffic and all that other good stuff, and then we're going to talk more about this, got your phone calls on this, got some Tigers news, and we're going to go into what Notre Dame's Mount Rushmore looks like, the NFL.com thing that we've kind of had an extravaganza mini-series on this week. Theirs came out today, so we're going to go over that and think from a college point of view, in college only, who would you put on Notre Dame's Mount Rushmore? And you got any thoughts on the whole Mount Rushmore for college players thing? We'd love to take those calls. It's been a fun segment, and we're doing it one more time today. All that and more. Hour number one in the books. Hour number two on the way. A Friday edition of the Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Irving for three. Irving fakes, drives. James on the throwdown. James down low. Back up top. J.R. Smith for three. James to Thompson. Oh, what a pass from LeBron James. 31-9. Irving the crossover. Irving the pull-up. Tries again. Connects. James the crossover. The layup off the glass. Or Dante Jones inside. Layup is good. Curry the rebound. Green down the other end. James right there. Blocked by James. Kyrie Irving misses. Tristan Thompson hauls in the rebound. His 11th of the game, finds James. Here's Irving, four to shoot. Finds Tristan Thompson, out to Love for three. Bang! Pass inside, stolen by Irving. Throws it ahead to Smith. Smith, alley-oop to James! Wow!
Crowd going crazy. J.R. Smith in transition, recognizing the locomotive running down the middle of the floor is not how you drive, it's how you arrive. Mama, there goes that man.
It's bedlam here in Cleveland. Curry blocked by James.
Making a statement on both sides of the floor. Says to the two-time MVP, get it out of here. Not on my watch.
Thompson misses his third free throw of the night. As Tristan Thompson able to get that deflected rebound. And a foul on Curry, and Curry's going to get it with a technical. He throws his mouthpiece after fouling out of the game.
And it hit a fan, Mike.
Well, that had nothing to do with the outcome. The outcome was decided. He had every right to be upset. You know, he's the MVP of the league. He gets six fouls called on him. Three of them were absolutely ridiculous. You know, he steals the ball from Kyrie clean. LeBron flops on the last one. Jason Phillips falls for that for a flop. This is the MVP of the league. We're talking about these touch fouls in the NBA Finals. Let me be clear. We did not lose because of the officiating. They totally outplayed us, and Cleveland deserved to win. Three of the six fouls were incredibly inappropriate calls.
I didn't think I fouled either Kyrie or LeBron. That's just kind of my perception of the plays, and I had a reaction to it. You know, it's obviously frustrating fouling out in the fourth quarter of a clinching game and not being out there with my teammates, so it got the best of me, but you know, I'll be all right for the next game.
I just thought, you know, we stuck with our game plan, you know, being aggressive and physical defensively, and I thought being aggressive offensively of attacking. Just our guys' fight and our determination and never want to give in.
Well, man, we'll just focus on the next game. And focus on the next minute. We focused on the game plan that we had to master up, to try to even, get to, the next play, and it wasn't even trying to get to a game seven. We was like, okay, well, and once we went to game five, we went out there and being down 3-1, we was like, okay, well, we got to go home anyway. So let's go home and play in front of our fans. And tonight, these guys were, unbelievable. Once again, Double T's energy and activity, his level, his rebounding, obviously giving us extra possessions, but, his defensive rebounding from the beginning was at an all-time high level for himself. Even though as great as he was a spectacular tonight, and Kyrie just a floor general. He does what he does. It's no surprise what he does. And, we put ourselves in position to be able to, to be in the game seven.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And welcome back in hour number two here this Friday edition of the Extravaganza. Jim Cushlin, Chris Lemieux hanging out with you. Bob off today. He'll be back in the big chair when we talk some history coming up on Monday's show. I say we're going to definitely talk history. You can absolutely book that one right now. Because now that we have a Game 7 in these finals, Cavs-Warriors, it'll be back out in Oakland, 7 o'clock pregame time coming up on Sunday here on The Ticket, just after 8 o'clock for the tip for that one. And as I mentioned last hour, we're going to be talking historical things coming up on Monday's edition of this show, no matter how you slice it, no matter who wins on Sunday. Because again, think about it. On the one hand, if the Warriors get the win, they'll win their back-to-back championships with the back-to-back MVP, who is becoming the current face of the league. The debates, you've heard them all season long. Is Curry the best player on the planet, supplanting LeBron now? They win 73 games to break the all-time wins record. And many will then, if they win, try to say this is the greatest team of all time. By the way, I am not on that bandwagon, especially after watching what happened in the Oklahoma City series, even though they came back and won that one, and what so far happened in this series. I'm now more on Scottie Pippen's side than I think I've ever been on my life. Remember a couple months back, the playoffs are so long in the NBA, it was a couple months ago. A couple months back where he said, oh yeah, if our Bulls team was 72 wins, if we played this Warriors team, we would sweep them. Every day that's gone by since the Warriors went down 3-1 to Oklahoma City, I become more and more convinced that something like that is probably very true. So even if Golden State wins, I will be taking the side that the 96 Bulls were still the greatest team of all time, even though they fell one win short. Let's put it this way. They had nothing in terms of adversity the way the Warriors have in these playoffs. Nobody was injured. They didn't go down 3-1 to anybody. And they didn't let somebody crawl all the way back from being down 3-1 to force a game seven. They had two sweeps. No, they had one sweep, a five-game series. They had a six-game series in the East Finals. And then though the record books say that 96-72 win Bulls team won 4-2 against Seattle, don't forget, Chicago was actually up 3-0 in that series, and it's actually major kudos to the Sonics of that season to even force a game six. So that team never had that kind of adversity going through the playoffs the way this Warriors team has had with injuries and having to come back and then blowing this one. But all that historical stuff will still be there, and the debate will then rage on, did we just see the greatest team of all time? On the other hand, if the Cavs win, the entire conversation we've had for the last 2 weeks about LeBron and his legacy, kind of almost on the assumption that it would be 2-5 in the finals, gets completely flipped on its head. In my opinion, LeBron goes back to being the face of the league and the greatest player in the game if he's able to pull this off. I've said the historical notes about how no team has ever come back in the finals when down 3-1. Only two, heck, have forced the game seven. Now three. They'd also be one of only four teams to be also down 0-2 in the finals and come back and win, which joins one other team in NBA history to be down 0-2 and 3-1 in a series and come back to win it. And then, of course, the cherry on top of that one is the famed and infamous Cleveland curse will be over. And yes, I know Bob says he doesn't believe in that stuff. I kind of sometimes do. Which is part of the reason I'm publicly saying, among other reasons, that I think the Warriors will win Game 7. because I know I know what will happen if I say the Cavs will. I am that superstitious right now. I'm not going to lie about it. So one way or another, Monday's show, we're going to be talking about something historical, which we certainly wouldn't have thought of this time Monday, even in a Game 5 that didn't feature Draymond Green, which turned out to be one of the big differences, among others, in that game. But he was back yesterday, and outside of 10 rebounds, he was kind of a ghost. And he was getting dominated. And it's going to be fascinating to see how this all goes down. Do the Cavs have one more in them? That's what many, obviously, in the Cleveland area hope for. And I got something to say that I'm waiting till the end of the show. I'm going to leave thoughts I'm going to leave you all with at the end of this hour. And it's all based on the fact that, yes, there's the Cleveland angle, of course. Sorry about that. But I couldn't help but notice, as I'm sure some of you have already as well, that this Game 7 will also be taking place on Father's Day. And so I got thoughts on fathers and sports. I'm going to try to hopefully not mumble through it too much towards the end of the show, because I got some thoughts on that. Because, yes, for those who hadn't rechecked their calendars, especially if a Cleveland win happens on Sunday, that Sunday is also Father's Day. Very, very interestingly appropriate if it goes down. So I got some thoughts on a little bit of that later on. We can take phone calls and are taking calls right now at 866-240-1065. Open phones this hour. We are guest-free for the remainder of this Friday. You got thoughts on what we saw in Game 6? What your thoughts on how Game 7 is going to go down? I especially want those. Give me your predictions for Game 7 of the finals on Sunday, because there won't be another show until Monday when it's all recap and talking historical things. Coming up on Monday's edition. So give me your thoughts anytime this hour at 866-240-1065. Who do you think is going to win Game 7? But, of course, that's not the only thing going on in sports and in the region. The Detroit Tigers are in action again today, second game of their four-game series in Kansas City. And though they got a win last night, and from my Cleveland vantage point, I say thank you because the Indians are now alone in first place again, only by a half game, because they got swept by those very same Royals. The Tigers got a win, but it sure was one of those days that don't feel like a win, because J.D. Martinez breaks his elbow. He got put on the DL officially, because one of the things or people I follow on Twitter is literally MLB roster moves. And anytime a major league team makes a roster moves, I get a tweet about it. That tweet came in, I am not kidding you, 10 minutes after that game went final last night. J.D. Martinez on the DL. The prospect, that this will be interesting, of course, Steven Moya gets a call. I'm fascinated to see how he does. But J.D. Martinez, not as bodacious this year as he was these last couple years, but still playing very, very well. 12 homers, 39 RBIs. He's batting .286. He is now out on the DL with a broken elbow. He's going to miss at least a month. And that is certainly a guy you don't want to take out of that lineup. You talk about the Tigers' lineups. And, you know, injuries happen, especially baseball, over the course of 162. Right now, I look at this Tigers lineups, and I keep feeling, here are the main guys you cannot have injuries to, and there won't be a problem. J.D. Martinez, Miguel Cabrera, Ian Kinsler. Any one of those guys goes down for an extended period of time, which J.D. now has, there's going to be issues. Be nice to see what Steven Moya can do with now an extended call-up. He's certainly going to get a few starts out there. But J.D. Martinez out for at least the next month with a broken elbow. And I know Mike Miller, by the way, is just saw this little message from good old Mike Miller, who will be on at drive time here at the top of the hour. He's going to have John Wagner of the Blade on, who covers Bowling Green during that season, but he covers the Mud Hens during this part of the season. So he's obviously going to give you the primer for those who I've kind of tapped out on that one and haven't noticed. Give you the primer on Steven Moya and talk a little more about J.D. Martinez and where the Tigers go from here. That'll come up with Mike during drive time. So we can take thoughts on that. Not a good place for the Detroit Tigers to be. And then the other one, call it part three, if you will, of a extravaganza mini-series, your college football Mount Rushboards. We've been having tons and tons of fun with this over the last couple days. And it started a few days ago when Bob noticed that the NFL.com did a Mount Rushmore on Michigan, which actually happened to be the sixth total team that NFL.com, in conjunction with CFB College Football 24/7, and that their Mount Rushmores were based on, you know, NFL players that the school produced based on what they did in the NFL. That's why, to recap, Michigan's, for example, was Tom Brady, Charles Woodson, Steve Hutchinson, and Dan Dierdorf. Tom Brady being the most glaring example. He's on this Mount Rushmore because of what he did in the NFL, not what he did in Ann Arbor. Bob and I and you all, either on Facebook, on Twitter, or calling up the show, any of those options, by the way, totally good. And I love the Facebook's responses on our 106.5 Ticket Facebook page. We've gotten in response to the other day when I posted, actually it was about this time yesterday, when I posted my Mount Rushmore for what they did in college for Michigan, Ohio State, Notre Dame. But I also added Toledo, Bowling Green, and of course, because it's me, guys, I threw in Virginia Tech, which incidentally was the easiest one for me to do. Okay, I only had to actually think about the fourth spot. The other three came to me within 2 seconds. So that's up there, and I'm loving the responses. We got a ton of responses. Todd asked, why no Barry Church? And a perfect response, because this is what my response would be. Yeah, Church was great. Yes, he was, but who do you take off? I think they got it right. This has been the fun conversation about this. Who do you take off? Because a Mount Rushmore implies you could only put four guys up there. So we've had some guys, people also throw out some other random schools. I see Pitt and TCU among others on here. So, and we've got plenty of time. Go post that on our Facebook page as well. And by the way, before we get into the nitty gritty, which is the fact that Notre Dame came out today on the NFL.com site, Notre Dame, and they did this, remember, on the NFL one, they did this based on the 10 schools who have sent the most players all time to the NFL. And it goes in order. 10 was Tennessee, 9 Miami, 8 LSU, 7 Oklahoma, 6 Nebraska, 5 was Michigan, 4 was Penn State, number 3 was Ohio State, and to recap who NFL.com put on their Ohio State Mount Rushmore for what they did in the NFL, was Orlando Pace, Paul Warfield, Chris Carter, and Jim Parker. Number 2 is USC, and number 1, just released maybe 3 hours ago, was Notre Dame. Here is Notre Dame's. Joe Montana, Alan Page, Paul Hornung, and Jerome Bettis. And that's a good based on those guys came out of Notre Dame, and it's based on what they did in the NFL. 866-240-1065. Who would your Mount Rushmore for be? And I don't care what school it's from. Any school you pick, I don't care. Give me your Mount Rushmores at 866-240-1065. I, of course, and this is what I'm mentioning that I posted on our Ticket Facebook page, and thank you so much again for all your responses. They've been great. Love it. I posted my list for Ohio State, Notre Dame, Michigan, as well as Toledo, Bowling Green, and Virginia Tech, because, you know, I went to Virginia Tech. It's my alma mater. Incidentally, I'm going to read them for you right now. My easiest one, get this one out of the way, because I know most of you don't care about this one. Virginia Tech, I gave it to Frank Beamer, Michael Vick, Bruce Smith, and the only one I had to think about was my fourth pick, which became D'Angelo Hall, who did some punt returning and was outstanding in the secondary during my time there in Blacksburg. And since Tech was always a defense and special teams kind of team, I had to give it to another defensive player. Not going to lie, the other three took me all of 2 seconds to think of. Tech was my easiest one. Now with that one out of the way, because I know you guys don't really care about that one. And Chris Lemieux, I know you got some thoughts on this as well, because it's just been such a fun topic. It's one of those we could do this segment for a whole week if we really wanted to.
And this one really fascinates me because, like, I you know, if you know me, I'm all like Detroit sports.
Yeah.
It's what I cover, Lions and all that stuff. But I grew up in a Notre Dame household. My dad went to Notre Dame.
My grandfather was a huge Notre Dame fan. I'm not going to lie, before you finish, out of the list that I came up with, where I say Virginia Tech was my easiest, Notre Dame, by the way, people, the hardest one for me to do. I kept feeling, I did my list about 3 times because I had to keep scratching off and putting different people in because I didn't want to leave them out.
Yeah,
but you can only go with 4 because that's what Mount Rushmore is all about.
Of football, you can find at least 3, 4, even 5 guys from Notre Dame
who
might make the
list. Sure.
Yeah.
And we're talking just what they did in college, not necessarily what they did at Notre Dame, which is what the NFL.com lists have been all about that got us really started on this. So obviously you've been thinking of this, and you say you're a Notre Dame kind of guy. So go ahead, Crispy. You have the floor first.
Right,
who is your Notre Dame Mount Rushmore?
Well, you know, I know I saw you took Montana
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was just saying you took Montana off yours for the college side of it.
Right, because I'm going just based on college. Right, and but, quite frankly, as great as Montana was, especially as a 49er, there were actually better quarterbacks when they were in when they were members of Irish.
I can respect that, but I kept Montana on mine, if only because of the chicken soup game, where it's like,
see,
yeah.
Touche. These are the problems that were stirred around in my head, which is why Notre Dame was the hardest.
As good with those Dan Devine years in college, too. So that's why I kept him on. And then I kept a personal favorite of mine on. You could go Tim Brown with this one, too, but I went Rakeem Ishmael, the Rocket, who, like, yeah,
that's
very
a debate
close.
I had. I had to put a modern player on mine, and my debate was between Ishmael and Tim Brown.
Right.
And my tiebreaker became, actually, strangely enough, what they did in the NFL.
And Tim Brown has the Heisman, sure, but for me, Rakeem was,
and
like,
the Heisman,
you know,
good point.
You had more years with Rakeem that I just really liked with him. And
I mean, believe he was
like
part of that 88 National Championship team as well, where Tim Brown didn't win a title at Notre Dame.
And I kept off Tony Rice, the quarterback from that one, as much as he is a personal favorite. I actually have his jersey. I love Tony Rice. And then, okay, so where are we at? So there's a couple of good, really defensive ends from there. I went with Ross Browner, again, kind of those Dan Devine years.
Yeah.
The 70s.
You can't really go wrong picking players from that Prasangin era before that,
right,
which were right on top of each other. You can't really go wrong picking top players from under either of those two coaches.
Sure. And then, going back a little further, and, like, I know he gets really glamorized because of Ronald Reagan and that awful movie and everything, but George Gipp, before he died, like, it's really hard to
understand. And incidentally, for those of you thinking that sounds so familiar, that's the Gipper.
But before he died, tragically, like, he was that good. He could have been one of the greatest football players.
He just happened
of
to play
generation.
In the 20s. That's the
right.
Which means we really. It's hard to even fathom what football was like back in those
days. We're talking
about
a school who decided to make the forward pass the critical part of their offensive game.
Which is part of the reason for it to explain one of the names on my list,
by the way. Sure, your turn here, yeah.
Okay, because my list, first of all, I did the same thing that Ohio State and Michigan, when you think of it from the college years, and there was a CBS, I think it was CBSSports.com, did their own list with our kind of criteria, what they did in college, and both for Ohio State and Michigan, they put the legendary coach, Bo Schembechler, and Woody Hayes, respectively. So taking that same approach, there's plenty of legendary coaches when it comes to Notre Dame that it's hard to just pick one. Do you go with Devine? Do you go with Prasangin before then? Do you go with Lou Holtz in the modern era? Well, for me, thinking of the legendary coach, because I felt you had to, even though it's a player thing usually, this is one of those programs where a legendary coach almost has to be part of the list. And for me, I gave it to Newt Rockne.
Of course.
He called it the forward pass, you know, because he was one of those innovators in those earliest days. Remember, this is the 1920s. Leather helmets. The concept of the NFL was just being born in Canton. It was all college football when you did play football before then. And in many ways, the way I think of Newt Rockne is, in some of the ways we think of how Paul Brown with the Cleveland Browns in the 40s and 50s helped modernize and revolutionize the NFL and modern-day football as we think of it today, Newt Rockne kind of did that in the 20s for football. In many ways, he helped create the simple concept of the forward pass, without which football is a totally different game than we see on Sundays or Saturdays today. So that was mine. It was more like rugby.
It would be
exactly
more like rugby. And he, you know, before Rockne and the Four Horsemen and everything else, like, the forward pass was kind of seen almost as like a trick play.
Exactly.
It's a desperation play. And Rockne's like, no, this is going to be the core of our offense.
And that's a revolutionary thing circa 1920-something in football, no matter what level. Just like how the best example of that, and I mentioned Paul Brown, was when Paul Brown invented cup blocking, which is the template for how you do pass protection to this day. So in many ways, that's why I went with Newt Rockne as my legendary coach, because he revolutionized how to play football in general. But there were many coaches to go from. After that, I went with players, and I figured I had to take some kind of quarterback. But I didn't go with Horte. I didn't go with Rice. I didn't go with Montana. I didn't even go with how NFL.com did with Horning. I went with the guy that came right before Horning. I went with Johnny Lujack.
This one almost made my list, too.
Why? Simple fact of the matter, folks. Dude was the starting quarterback on 3 national championship teams. 3. And you think about how college football is today. Nobody's winning three titles in college as a quarterback. The way college works and leaving college works nowadays, that'll never happen again.
And by the way, that era where he played too, if I remember, that's like, you know, the mid to late 40s or so.
Yes, because I believe he had a year or two off for service after the war.
But
and then he came back to Notre Dame.
This is the era of college football where Army and Navy basically have a monopoly.
Army won a national championship in 1945.
They have a monopoly on all these athletes because of all the men who were
in the service at the time for the war. Yes.
Yeah.
Notre Dame was one of the only schools at that time that was starting to break that and get those guys away from the two service academies who in the 40s were dominant. And yes, folks, that's not a joke. There was actually a time when Army was a good football team.
One of the greatest games of all time was like a 0-0 tie between Notre Dame and Army.
Right,
like
46 or 44 or whatever. So I went with, of all the quarterbacks I could pick, I went with Lou Jack because the dude won three national championships, and I promise you, you're never going to see a college quarterback do that again because he'll leave for the pros after the second one. Number three, I went with another guy from back in those earlier days, Johnny Lattner. And the reason I went with him, he was huge on offense, was leading or near the leading of the nation in receiving touchdowns, receiving yards, all those kind of things. The capper for me, why I put him on my Rushmore list, see, these were back in the days when you played both sides of the ball.
He had
15 career interceptions as a corner. So he basically, outside of kicking, you gave him shoulder pads and an old leather helmet and put him on the field, and he could do everything. In another way, just like Lou Jack with his three national titles, in a way that you'll just never, ever see again. And my fourth guy, and we kind of alluded to this one because you went with Ismail, and I went with Tim Brown because you had to get somebody from a more modern era. Tim Brown won a Heisman. He's an all-time great in the NFL. He'll be in the Hall of Fame. He's actually one of the people that the NFL.com list specifically mentioned as other candidates we had to leave off. And just because of what, and he was, even though Ismail was part of the 88 national title team under Lou Holtz, I went with Brown. Twistedly enough, because I kind of felt that Ismail and Brown were kind of coin flips to me. So I'm not going to lie. I went with Tim Brown as my tiebreaker was what they did in the NFL. And, of course, as you mentioned to me to remind me, part of the reason Ismail didn't have a good NFL career is because he didn't really go to the NFL.
He went to the Canadian football.
They drove a dump truck full of money up to his dorm so he would go to the Canadian league instead. And he took the bait. He got himself paid. Good for him. But he didn't go to the NFL, and that's kind of why I gave it to Tim Brown, because I kind of thought a lot of things they did were kind of equal. Brown won a Heisman, but Ismail won a national title. Right. They were two of the most outstanding receivers ever to come through Notre Dame, but one had a legendary NFL career, and the other one simply didn't.
For whatever reason. He had service in like the NFL for, I think, like 8-7 years or so. But, yeah, no, he didn't have what Tim Brown
had, which is legitimate Hall of Fame type thing. So that's my list. My Notre Dame, to recap, my Mount Rushmore for Notre Dame was Newt Rockne, Johnny Lujack, Johnny Lattner, and Tim Brown. But I'm here to tell you, folks, Notre Dame's list was by far my most difficult. 866-240-1065. Numbers to join us. If you got a Mount Rushmore list for Michigan, Ohio State, Notre Dame, Michigan State, I don't care. Lay it on me at 866-240-1065. Also, definitely taking calls. You got a Game 7 of the Finals prediction for Sunday as well. Love to hear that as well. Post this also again, as I mentioned, on our Facebook page. Got a lot of great responses from it when I posted it yesterday. But I'm going to read real quick what to recap for those who aren't on Facebook or something like that right now. Maybe you're driving. Here were my Mount Rushmores that I posted yesterday for all the other schools. First for Michigan. And again, my criteria is not what the NFL.com site did. My criteria is what you did in college only. For me, my Mount Rushmore for Michigan is Desmond Howard, Charles Woodson, Anthony Carter, and Bo Schembechler. Because some programs, you just got to put the legendary coach, if applicable, up there. Much the same that I did with Frank Beamer on Virginia Tech. And if I were to do a Penn State list, yes, despite how it ended, you have to have Joe Pa on a Mount Rushmore for Penn State. Now, I know some of you out there are saying, but that whole incident was... I know, but... For 35, 40 years before that, Joe Paterno was Penn State football. We all acknowledge that fact. So for moving on to Ohio State, my Mount Rushmore for the Buckeyes was Archie Griffin, Eddie George, Chris Spielman, and then legendary coach again, Woody Hayes. And by the way, no, unless he wins like three more national titles, I would never take Woody Hayes off for Urban Meyer. Sorry, he's got to win a couple more national titles because Woody Hayes is or was Ohio State, period. For Notre Dame, I just mentioned it, Newt Rockne, Johnny Lattner, Johnny Lujack, and Tim Brown. Also dove into a few others. I'm not going to mention Tech again. I already started with them. But I also did, I happen to do because why not? It's right here. And you know you won't get this from CBS or ESPN or NFL.com. They'll never do one for Toledo and Bowling Green. So without further ado, my Mount Rushmore for the Toledo Rockets. Start with Mel Long. One of the few, not just Toledo players, but MAC players to ever end up in the College Hall of Fame. He was the defensive leader, specifically in 70-71, when they were on that ridiculous streak. And as a defense, he was the anchor of it. And that defense, I guess it was good. They gave up 7.6 points a game. That's ridiculous. And Mel Long, a College Football Hall of Famer, was absolutely the leader and the anchor of that squad. Staying in the exact same era, but going to the offensive side of the ball, Chuck Ealy, whose reasoning for being on my Toledo Mount Rushmore can simply be summed up like this. 35-0. Let me repeat that for those of you who had forgotten. Chuck Ealy, as the starting quarterback for the Toledo Rockets, had a career record of 35-0. I don't care if you're in Division I, 1AA, Division III, or NAIA. You are awesome if you are undefeated as a quarterback with that many games. I don't even feel I need to say anymore, but I will. He was eighth in the Heisman voting in 1971. And MAC players just don't get on Heisman voting lists unless they're really super awesome. And Chuck Ealy absolutely was. Also on my list, you guys know this guy very well. We've had him on this show and others before on these very airwaves. The one and only Bruce Gradkowski. Because he's the modern day awesome quarterback that came through Toledo. And my number four, when he left the Rockets, he was the all-time leading rusher and had a decent NFL career to boot, Chester Taylor. So there's my Toledo Rockets, Mount Rushmore, Chuck Ealy, Bruce Gradkowski, Mel Long, and Chester Taylor. For Bowling Green, my Mount Rushmore looks like this. We start with Brian McClure, who, when he was done as Bowling Green's quarterback, he was 30-6 as the starting quarterback for BG, and he was second in career NCAA passing yards, which has been since eclipsed by a whole bunch of guys since then because this was the mid-80s. But when he left Bowling Green, he was second all-time career NCAA passing yards list. That's remarkable, even though about five or six guys have passed him and the guy who was number one at the time since then. And, oh, by the way, not too shabby were those Bowling Green teams because McClure's quarterback was had a 30-6 record. Or spun it different, because I apologize, there were some ties in there, so that's wrong. But he won 30 of his 36 games. Next on the list, Martin Bayless, also from those early 80s. He was a four-year starter. He was second when he left Bowling Green. He was the career Mid-American Conference leader in tackles, which was second on the career NCAA list at the time. Again, like the McClure passing yard thing, that's since been eclipsed by a whole bunch of guys. But in 1983, when Bayless was done at Bowling Green, he was second career NCAA and MAC career leader in tackles. He led the nation in interceptions in 1983. And in that very same year, 1983, also something that doesn't happen to MAC players very often, he was a third-team All-American. So Martin Bayless on my list. Next, we have Dave Preston, played in the mid-70s. When he left Bowling Green after 1977, he was the career rushing leader in Falcon history. He was fifth in the nation in 1974, which, by the way, is his freshman year, in rushing yards and rushing touchdowns. And when he left Bowling Green, he had 10 different MAC records. And finally, my final guy on my Bowling Green Mount Rushmore is Don Nealon from the mid and late 50s. He was 21-2-4 as quarterback of the Falcons, led them to the Mid-American Conference title way back in 1956, was part of a program, though he had finished his playing days before they won the 1959 national championship. It was called a different division kind of thing back then, but that comes down to us today as Division II. So yes, there is a Bowling, look it up, people, there is a Bowling Green national championship for football. It was called something different in 1959. We know it today as Division II. Don Nealon was the quarterback right before that team. And like I said, he won a MAC title in 56, 21-2-4 as a quarterback for Bowling Green. And oh, by the way, in the mid-60s, he would become the head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons as well. So there's your Bowling Green Mount Rushmore, according to me, Jim Cushlin, Brian McClure, Martin Bayless, Dave Preston, and Don Nealon. 866-240-1065. You got thoughts on your Mount Rushmore. You got thoughts on Game 7. We're taking them all. Only a few more minutes here on this Friday edition to take some of those phone calls. Quick timeout. Check a traffic. Check a weather. Local Sports Center update. And then we wrap up the show with some of your phone calls before we turn it over to drive time here on this Friday edition of the Extravaganza. Jim Cushlin, Chris Lemieux in for Bob France on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
And welcome back in. Final segment here of this Friday edition of the Extravaganza here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Jim Cushlin, Chris Lemieux hanging out. Bob France off today. He'll be back on Monday. And as I mentioned, we will definitely be talking something historical. We just don't know from what angle yet we will be talking about it, but it will be something about historical nature of what we're going to see in Game 7 coming up on Sunday night. Because, again, whoever wins, there's going to be definite historical accolades that must be then thrown their way. And, again, it's regardless of who wins, whether it's the Warriors or the Cavs winning it on Sunday night game. By the way, again, you'll be able to hear right here on 106.5 The Ticket. A few more minutes to take some phone calls at 866-240-1065. And, you know, this Game 7 coming up. And, again, my thoughts on the Mount Rushmores, too. We got a few more minutes to take those calls as well. I keep thinking about this Game 7 and just how much is really still stacked up against the Cavs in this one? You know, the whole down 3-1, even throwing in down 0-2 because they were that. And I keep thinking ever since they went down 3-1, the fact that they were down 0-2 seems to get forgotten, but that still would go in the books, you know, at down 0-2 as well. But, you know, only two other times prior to this has there even been a Game 7 forced in the finals after somebody was down 3-1. It's only been down 0-2 to win an NBA Finals has only happened three times. The last in 0-6 when Shaq and Wade and the Heat beat them Dallas. You got the fact that home teams are 15-3 in Game 7. But this series to go to Game 7, especially on the backs of what we've seen LeBron James do these last couple of games, is just truly remarkable. And to go back-to-back 40 games, he was in complete control in both games. And I know a lot, some fans have been hearing this one grumbling over the last 12 to 24 hours. Where was this earlier in the series? You know, he'd been so, you know, it's amazing how some guys, you know, can just turn it on or play in ways that you're still not sure how that's possible. Example. They always say, you know, you shouldn't play when you're angry because you make mistakes when you're angry. Yet it's widely remembered that back in the day, Jackie Robinson played his best baseball when he was hopping mad. You got to wonder if the same thing is applying to LeBron James right now. He got called out by literally everybody. Klay Thompson, Draymond. Said he was soft, man's league, all that kind of stuff. You poked the bear. And now the bear is coming after your lunch at the campsite. And if he's got one more of these in him, then what we may see coming up on Sunday, it could just be that truly historic. And it would change the whole conversation that we've been having in recent days and weeks about a LeBron legacy, where his status is right now in the NBA. And most of that is because as soon as that series went down 0-2, after two games, myself included, we all kind of assumed it would eventually end in a Golden State win. So that's why we've already been talking about the where does LeBron stack up if he falls to 2-5 in the finals, as if that was, you know, completely assumed. And that still may very well be. You know, this game's still out at Oracle. Do the Cavs have enough to win one more game on the road? Most of the times in situations like this, you just get that one on the road and hope for the best. They did. Do they have another one in them? But I truly believe you have to say that LeBron James is the best player in the NBA, the best player on the planet, all over again, if he and the Cavs can finish this off coming up on Sunday, to come back from down 3-1, to do it against a team that won 73 games with the two-time MVP, defending MVP, to break the whole Cleveland thing. Heck, before all those other notations about the Warriors and such, most were speculating that his legacy would have an interesting, you know, effect if he were to win that title for a Cleveland team. And now it's even going to go above and beyond that, where the whole breaking the Cleveland thing is the cherry on top add-on to the whole thing. And even though every game in this series has been decided by double-digit points, there hasn't been a close game truly in this series at all, and there may not be one in Game 7, who knows? But it's still promising to quite possibly be one of the most exciting Game 7s, and for historical purposes, quite possibly one of the most important Game 7s there's ever been in the NBA Finals, just because of how history gets written based on who wins this game. 7 o'clock the pregame time. It'll be over on 106.5 The Ticket right here. 8 o'clock the tip-off time. But before we go today, I mentioned this a little bit earlier. I know we're up against it, and you hit your little buttons, Chris, whenever you got to. That's the whole point of them. I do want to leave you with a couple of thoughts that have been going in my head ever since this game went final last night. So, yes, if it's some of it's from the Cleveland perspective and it's clouding my judgment, sue me. But I couldn't help but notice, I'm sure some of you out there did too, that Sunday is also Father's Day. And when it comes to sports, whether you're playing or following teams and rooting for, most of your knowledge, and most of you can think about this and remember it, comes from your fathers. Your fathers taught you the games, taught you how to play. The games then help you in life. How many times have you heard Bob mention relating to football, discipline and teamwork and all those kind of things that you learn to become a man? You can learn a lot of those things by playing on the team, by learning the game. Fathers also come in that big way because usually when you think about who you're rooting for, whatever team or whatever sport it is, you usually get that from your father. It's passed down from father to son through the generations. His father taught him the same way. That's how you're a Tigers fan or an Indians fan or a Lions fan or whatever. Through the generations, it all comes to us and comes down that way. And especially if you're a Cleveland person on this upcoming Father's Day, to be able to see something that maybe your father was a child for the last time it happened, if he was even alive at all, let alone you. And it all come to a head. And it reminds you about those things as you grow up and as you learn your way in the world and have those important life lessons, sports being one of them, that's passed down from father to son. So it might be a very, very interesting Father's Day coming up for a lot of Cleveland fans. I know it will be for me as well. So happy Father's Day coming up on Sunday. Enjoy Game 7. Enjoy the weekend. Bob will be back on Monday. Mike Miller on Drive Time is next. Stick around for that. Have a good weekend.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.